Chapter 14. He waited for a moment, then cautiously, as if not to give offense, I don't think we need lose much of that stuff, sir, he said. I can sweep it up, every bit of it almost, and then we could sift the glass out. I will go about it at once. It will not make the breakfast late, not 10 minutes. Oh, yes, I said bitterly. At the breakfast wait, sweep up every bit of it, and then throw the damned lot overboard. The profound silence returned, and when I looked over my shoulder, Ransom the intelligent, serene Ransom had vanished from my side. The intense loneliness of the sea acted like poison on my brain. When I turned my eyes to the ship, I had a morbid vision of her as a floating grave. Who hasn't heard of ships found floating, haphazard, with their crews all dead? I looked at the seaman at the helm. I had an impulse to speak to him, and, indeed, his face took on an expectant cast, as if he had guessed my intention. But in the end I went below, thinking I would be alone with the greatness of my trouble for a little while. But through his open door Mr. Burns saw me come down, and addressed me grumpily, well, sir? I went in. He isn't well at all, I said. Mr. Burns, re-established in his bed place, was concealing his hirsute cheek in the palm of his hand. That confounded fellow has taken away the scissors from me, were the next words he said. The tension I was suffering from was so great, that it was perhaps just as well that Mr. Burns had started on his grievance. He seemed very sore about it and grumbled, "Does he think I am mad, or what?" "I don't think so, Mr. Burns," I said. I looked upon him at that moment as a model of self-possession. I even conceived on that account a sort of admiration for that man, who had, apart from the intense materiality of what was left of his beard, come as near to being a disembodied spirit as any man can do and live. I noticed the preternatural sharpness of the ridge of his nose, the deep cavities of his temples, and I envied him. He was so reduced that he would probably die very soon. Enviable man! So near extinction, while I had to bear within me a tumult of suffering vitality, doubt, confusion, self-reproach, and an indefinite reluctance to meet the horrid logic of the situation. I could not help muttering, I feel as if I were going mad myself. Mr. Burns glared spectrally, but otherwise wonderfully composed. I always thought he would play us some deadly trick, he said, with a peculiar emphasis on the he. It gave me a mental shock, but I had neither the mind, nor the heart, nor the spirit to argue with him. My form of sickness was indifference. The creeping paralysis of a hopeless outlook. So I only gazed at him. Mr. Burns broke into further speech. Eh? What? No. You won't believe it? Well, how do you account for this? How do you think it could have happened? Happened? I repeated dully. Hi, yes, how in the name of the infernal powers did this thing happen? Indeed, on thinking it out, it seemed incomprehensible that it should just be like this. The bottles emptied, refilled, rewrapped, and replaced. A sort of plot, a sinister attempt to deceive, a thing resembling sly vengeance, but for what? Or else a fiendish joke. But Mr. Burns was in possession of a theory. It was simple, and he uttered it solemnly in a hollow voice. I suppose they have given him about £15 in Afon for that little lot. Mr. Burns! I cried. He nodded grotesquely over his raised legs, like two broomsticks in the pajamas, with enormous bare feet at the end. Why not? The stuff is pretty expensive in this part of the world, and they were very short of it in Tonkin. And what did he care? You have not known him. I have, and I have defied him. He feared neither God, nor devil, nor man, nor wind, nor sea, nor his own conscience. And I believe he hated everybody and everything. But I think he was afraid to die. I believe I am the only man who ever stood up to him. I faced him in that cabin where you live now, when he was sick, and I cowed him then. He thought I was going to twist his neck for him. If he had had his way, we would have been beating up against the northeast monsoon, as long as he lived and afterward too, for ages and ages. Acting the Flying Dutchman in the China Sea. Ha! Ha! But why should he replace the bottles like this? I began. Why shouldn't he? Why should he want to throw the bottles away? They fit the drawer. They belong to the medicine chest. And they were wrapped up, I cried. Well, the wrappers were there. Did it from habit, I suppose, and as to refilling, there is always a lot of stuff they send in paper parcels that burst after a time. And then, who can tell? I suppose you didn't taste it, sir? But, of course, you are sure. No, I said. Didn't taste it. It is all overboard now. Behind me, a soft, cultivated voice said, colon, I have tasted it. It seemed a mixture of all sorts, sweetish, saltish, very horrible. Ransom, stepping out of the pantry, had been listening for some time, as it was very excusable in him to do. A dirty trick, said Mr. Burns. Always said he would. The magnitude of my indignation was unbounded. And the kind, sympathetic doctor too. The only sympathetic man I ever knew. Instead of writing that warning letter, the very refinement of sympathy, why didn't the man make a proper inspection? But, as a matter of fact, it was hardly fair to blame the doctor. The fittings were in order and the medicine chest is an officially arranged affair. There was nothing really to arouse the slightest suspicion. The person I could never forgive was myself. Nothing should ever be taken for granted. The seed of everlasting remorse was sown in my breast. I feel it's all my fault, I exclaimed. Mine and nobody else's. That's how I feel. I shall never forgive myself. That's very foolish, sir, said Mr. Burns fiercely. And after this effort he fell back exhausted on his bed. He closed his eyes, he panted. This affair, this abominable surprise had shaken him up too. As I turned away I perceived Ransom looking at me blankly. He appreciated what it meant, but managed to produce his pleasant, wistful smile. Then he stepped back into his pantry, and I rushed up on deck again to see whether there was any wind, any breath under the sky, any stir of the air, any sign of hope. The deadly stillness met me again. Nothing was changed, except that there was a different man at the wheel. He looked ill. His whole figure drooped, and he seemed rather to cling to the spokes than hold them with a controlling grip. I said to him, "You are not fit to be here." "I can manage, sir," he said feebly. As a matter of fact, there was nothing for him to do. The ship had no steerage way. She lay with her head to the westward, the everlasting coring visible over the stern, with a few small islets, black spots in the great blaze, swimming before my troubled eyes. And but for those bits of land there was no speck on the sky, no speck on the water, no shape of vapor, no wisp of smoke, no sail, no boat, no stir of humanity, no sign of life, nothing. The first question was, what to do? What could one do? The first thing to do obviously was to tell the men. I did it that very day. I wasn't going to let the knowledge simply get about. I would face them. They were assembled on the quarter deck for the purpose. Just before I stepped out to speak to them, I discovered that life could hold terrible moments. No confessed criminal had ever been so oppressed by his sense of guilt. This is why, perhaps, my face was set hard, and my voice curt and unemotional while I made my declaration that I could do nothing more for the sick in the way of drugs. As to such care as could be given them, they knew they had had it. I would have held them justified in tearing me limb from limb. The silence which followed upon my words was almost harder to bear than the angriest uproar. I was crushed by the infinite depth of its reproach. But, as a matter of fact, I was mistaken. In a voice which I had great difficulty in keeping firm, I went on, colon, I suppose, men, you have understood what I said, and you know what it means. A voice or two were heard, colon, yes, sir. We understand. They had kept silent simply because they thought that they were not called to say anything. And when I told them that I intended to run into Singapore, and that the best chance for the ship and the men was in the efforts all of us, sick and well, must make to get along out of this, I received the encouragement of a low assenting murmur, and of a louder voice exclaiming, colon, surely there is a way out of this blamed hole. Here is an extract from the notes I wrote at the time. We have lost Koering at last. For many days now I don't think I have been 2 hours below altogether. I remain on deck, of course, night and day, and the nights and the days wheel over us in succession, whether long or short, who can say? All sense of time is lost in the monotony of expectation, of hope, and of desire which is only one. Get the ship to the southward. Get the ship to the southward. The effect is curiously mechanical. The sun climbs and descends, the night swings over our heads, as if somebody below the horizon were turning a crank. It is the prettiest, the most aimless. And all through that miserable performance I go on, tramping the deck. How many miles have I walked on the poop of that ship? A stubborn pilgrimage of sheer restlessness, diversified by short excursions below to look upon Mr. Burns. I don't know whether it is an illusion, but he seems to become more substantial from day to day. He doesn't say much, for, indeed, the situation doesn't lend itself to idle remarks. I notice this even with the men as I watch them moving or sitting about the decks. They don't talk to each other. It strikes me that, if there exists an invisible ear catching the whispers of the earth, it will find this ship the most silent spot on it. No, Mr. Burns has not much to say to me. He sits in his bunk with his beard gone, his mustaches flaming, and with an air of silent determination on his chalky physiognomy. Ransom tells me he devours all the food that is given him to the last scrap, but that, apparently, he sleeps very little. Even at night, when I go below to fill my pipe, I notice that, though dozing flat on his back, he still looks very determined. From the side glance he gives me, when awake it seems as though he were annoyed at being interrupted in some arduous mental operation. And as I emerge on deck, the ordered arrangement of the stars meets my eye, unclouded, infinitely wearisome. There they are. Stars, sun, sea, light, darkness, space, great waters, the formidable work of the 7 days, into which mankind seems to have blundered unbidden, or else decoyed. Even as I have been decoyed into this awful, this death-haunted command. The only spot of light in the ship at night was that of the compass lamps, lighting up the faces of the succeeding helmsmen. For the rest we were lost in the darkness, I walking the poop and the men lying about the decks. They were all so reduced by sickness that no watches could be kept. Those who were able to walk remained all the time on duty, lying about in the shadows of the main deck, till my voice raised for an order would bring them to their enfeebled feet, a tottering little group. Mauve. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.